What if everything we thought we knew about remote work was wrong? During the pandemic, millions discovered that working from home wasn't the liberation they'd imagined. It was labor under siege. We weren't experiencing true remote work, but rather a desperate scramble to survive while confined to our living rooms. This distinction matters more than we realize. The crisis exposed something deeper. Our entire relationship with work is fundamentally broken, whether we're in cubicles or at kitchen tables. The real question isn't where we work, but why we've allowed work to consume our entire existence. When Twitter's Jack Dorsey and Shopify's Toby Lutke publicly endorsed a radical reimagining of work culture, they weren't just jumping on a trend. They were acknowledging that the old system was dying. The future isn't about Zoom calls replacing conference rooms. It's about escaping the wheel of constant productivity that's been grinding us down for decades. Corporate America loves flexibility, but here's the translation. You're flexible, the company isn't. Arise Service Partners, remote call center workers for Amazon, Apple, and Airbnb, must buy their own equipment, pay for training, compete for shifts, and receive no benefits because they're classified as independent contractors. They have freedom to work whenever they want, as long as they accept poverty wages and zero protection. This is fissuring. Companies systematically outsourcing labor to avoid providing benefits or healthcare. Corporations get stability while workers get anxiety. For those keeping full-time positions, this anxiety birthed productivity culture. The performance of constant busyness through visible tasks and weekend Slack messages to prove indispensability. One writer's friend reserved 9:11 p.m. nightly after her children slept for her real work because meetings consumed her entire workday. Technology was supposed to make us efficient. Instead, it made us work more. Most managers have no idea how much time tasks require, especially invisible work, email management, Slack presence, organizational busy work. When people tracked their time during the pandemic, many discovered they could complete essential work in 30 to 35 hours weekly. The rest was performance. Remote work exposed a fundamental flaw. Without structure, work bleeds into every hour, not because of remote work itself, but because we imported dysfunctional office culture home. Personal boundaries fail when the entire system demands constant availability. We need guardrails instead, structural protections built into workplace culture. Front's email system, for example, prevents assignments near day's end, transforming email from personal burden to collaborative task. One employee called it a force field that bounces back others' disrespect for your time. Effective guardrails require proper funding. Companies must either temporarily lower productivity expectations during absences or maintain slightly more staff than necessary. Most operate with employees at 100 to 200% capacity, creating a cruel illusion where you technically have time off permission, but understand you'll pay for it by working during vacation, burdening colleagues, or letting work collapse. Pandemic-era professionals faced unique challenges without physical offices for learning through observation or building relationships naturally. They need structured mentorship, scheduled bonding, email templates, and clear workplace norms. David Perry, whose son has Down syndrome, advocates for universal design for work-life balance, policies allowing set leave time without interrogation, whether for childcare, health, or simply living fully. This prevents resentment between those with acceptable needs and those without, moving beyond accommodation-based flexibility available only for employer-approved ends. After World War II, National Cash Register's chairman celebrated how loyal employees immediately rebuilt his obliterated German factory. This anecdote opens an influential 1982 book on corporate culture. But should workers have prioritized rebuilding a factory amid devastation rather than caring for their families? Most companies tout aspirational culture statements disconnected from reality. True corporate culture lives in unwritten rules passed through office chats and after-work drinks. This tension between meaningful work and imposed schedules isn't new. Early factory owners complained that workers resisted regular hours, preferring pre-industrial autonomy. Management emerged to solve this problem, first through intimidation, then Frederick Winslow Taylor's scientific management around 1900, obsessively timing workers to eliminate waste motion. One machinist protested, "We are trying to regulate our work so as to make it auxiliary to our lives." Taylor's philosophy won. For decades, corporations offered financial security and belonging. Then the 1970s recession struck. Companies slashed over 300 million Fortune 500 jobs in the early 1980s, betraying workers who'd built identities around loyalty. Discarded employees experienced loss equivalent to divorce or death, losing income, social worlds, and identity itself. Corporate cynicism transformed managers from assets into costs, turning lifelong careers into relics. Companies systematically stripped away workers' stability while maintaining, "It's not personal, it's business." This legacy found its most toxic form in startup culture, which rejected traditional corporate norms, decorum, dress codes, departmental structure, and weaponized cynicism as entrepreneurship. The web fueled the belief that anyone could achieve staggering success and disrupt industries with minimal staff. Startup culture elevated founder worship to cultish levels while demanding all-consuming devotion to the company's utopian mission. Rejecting corporate structure meant eschewing hierarchies, HR departments, and organizational charts until absolutely necessary. This structural weakness, combined with hustle culture and productivity fetishization, spread beyond tech to become the new corporate ideal. All the exploitation of traditional corporations with none of the stability. HR systems became engineered to prevent abuse by a tiny minority rather than help the maximum number of people, constantly building systems that resist the worst-case scenario instead of enabling the best one. Paul Hershenson hasn't worked in an office for 30 years. He takes Fridays off for hiking. His company, Art Plus Logic, has built genuine culture among 65 employees who enjoy truly flexible, asynchronous work. A graphic designer restructured her schedule after childbirth to work midday and evenings, while a developer plays golf several times weekly. This works through clear communication and genuine trust that employees will deliver. The Nightingales discovered that poor management stems from ignorance, not malice. Most new managers are promoted for excelling at individual tasks, then thrown into leadership with minimal guidance, creating either micromanagers or absentee leaders. Flexible work success depends on middle management. Bad management allows inequities to grow and creates burnout, even in reduced-hour scenarios. Despite diversity initiatives, corporate leadership remains overwhelmingly white and male. Many companies approach DEI superficially, seeking quick-fix trainings rather than addressing underlying inequities. Real change requires seeing management as a discrete skill, requiring specific competencies, not treating it as a reward for productive individual contributors. Research from Meeting Science shows most workers spend 75% of their day in meetings, with only 20% being genuinely important. In the early 1990s, expensive laptops promised liberation from office constraints. That business dad in the Adirondack chair wasn't freed, he was imprisoned by work in nature. Our pocket supercomputers now enable work to infiltrate every moment. Video conferencing becomes Zoom fatigue. Collaborative messaging becomes surveillance. Shared calendars become ways for others to commandeer our time. Real solutions require reimagining work fundamentally. Dropbox went virtual first, creating redesigned studios for episodic collaboration rather than daily presence. The deepest transformation must happen in our communities. If your grandparents lived in America, they almost certainly belonged to social organizations. By 2000, Robert Putnam documented in Bowling Alone how these had declined dramatically. Mutual aid exemplifies a better approach. Unlike traditional charity, mutual aid embraces reciprocity. Everyone both gives and receives help without means testing or hierarchy. Community fridges operate on this principle, with the same people stocking and taking food as needed. True community isn't about joining another book club you'll resent. It's about finding networks that matter and establishing reciprocal care, recognizing we're not meant to optimize ourselves into isolated productivity machines, but to live full, interconnected lives where work is auxiliary to living, not the other way around.